Well, the paintings which were discovered in the palace in Shahristan, they were discovered already in the 60s. The proper analysis, however, in the publication of these remarkable finds was, however, delayed for various reasons. Nigmatov, Numan Nigmatov, who was the head of the delegation, the excavation team, he limited himself mainly to the general comments on the paintings, stating that the main subject was a battle between good and evil humans assisted by gods and demons. Now, other specialists of Sogdian art, for various reasons, they did not really comment on the Shahristan paintings. Today, we're in a much better position to finally attempt to offer an interpretation and to attempt a proper iconographical analysis of these paintings. This is thanks, first of all, to the publications of the three volumes produced by the Japanese and Tajik team, which was already mentioned, and especially thanks to the recent volume published by Vladimir Sokolovsky, which contains the reconstruction of the paintings. Now, the paintings from the small hall are probably the best preserved Sogdian epic paintings, because we have even the fragment of the third fragments of the third register preserved on all four walls, which is really a rare case in the Sogdian art. And then I worked on the Sogdian epic paintings from Penjiken 2 years ago. I thought that it is really, it doesn't make any sense that there is no interpretation for these paintings, which are so well preserved, and we can trace the entire narrative on the four walls. So I started thinking about it and making and trying to understand the inner logic of the composition and the interrelation, the iconographic interrelations between the various type of characters. At some stage, I shared my ideas and thoughts with Franz Grenet. From that point on, we began a collaboration and exchange of ideas, and we've been working together on this project, and it is really now what we present today is the result of our joint work. So first of all, I will start with the comment of on the dating, because usually the these paintings in the small hall were dated according to historical considerations, because the Afshins, the kings of Ustrushana, accepted formally accepted Islam in 822. It was this date was taken as a terminus antequem for the paintings. However, as we know, even in 841, during the famous trial of Haidar bin Kavus, Al-Afshin of Ustrushana, which took place in Baghdad, he was accused of supporting the local temples, of defending the local temples of local gods which were active in Ustrushana, which means that the native religion in Ustrushana continued at least until this date, so we cannot assume that the Islamization of the embrace of Islam by the rulers of Ustrushana should be viewed as a watershed for these paintings, which of course contain pre-Islamic gods and so on. So as was mentioned already before, and this is probably one of the major points, the dating, of course, of these paintings, the dating will be established only by joint study of iconography and stratigraphy and ceramics and coins, which is problematic. But even if it was produced, even if these paintings were produced in the 8th century, the palace probably could have continued functioning well into the 9th century, and even after Islamization, there is no reason to assume that the kings of Ustrushana would cease using this hall because of its pre-Islamic or non-Islamic motifs. So now you have already seen the reconstructions of the walls and the placement of the walls. So I'll just mention that we have three registers, and the placement and the composition fully corresponds to the tradition of Sogdian epic paintings in these so-called reception halls, as known from Penji Kent, from numerous examples. Yeah. The third register is static. The characters represented in the third register, we do not see any active movement. They are either standing, depicted frontally, or in some kind of procession. While in the lower and in the middle register, we have they are mainly dedicated to the epic battle. This is sufferable. Now, this battle was usually interpreted as the battle between good and evil, or between humans and demons. Now, I began, and we thought that the first step should be the proper identification of all types of characters which take place in the battle. And we were able to identify six types of various characters. First of all, we have animals. They are probably depicted all in the upper and in the middle register, and they take part in the battle. When we have the human, the main good side, I would say, they're represented in all registers and they take part in the battle. When we have the gods, they're clearly also represented everywhere and they take part in the battle assisting humans. When we have what I call demons, they're the proper, the real demons, as they should be, and they are depicted in the upper and in the middle register, and they do not take part in the battle. Another category, and this is an important iconographic distinction that we have made, that there is a category of humanoids with fangs, sometimes with crowns and sometimes with wings, that are distinct from these demons. We're going to see examples. And they're represented in all registers, and they do take part in the battle. And these humanoids with fangs and sometimes wings, they are the main opponent of the humans. And the sixth category, which was also went unnoticed, is what we call the certain kind of wild men. We're going to see them, and they also probably take part in the battle. So first of all, animals. These animals are represented only in the upper register. These are only wild and fantastic animals and only predators. They're represented in the upper register. And probably, I should correct myself here, we also have fragments from the middle register, somebody shooting the giant bird. So perhaps these animals also take part in the battle. Also here we have a claw of a giant bird depicted right under the divine flying creature, which is on the good side, and the direction is there. So probably the bird is also on the good side of the humans and the gods. And we have a very we have very interesting passages, especially in the Shahnameh, describing, which we are going to see, describing the army of various heroes of Gayomart, for example, where various wild animals are described as part of his army. So perhaps we're seeing here something like that. Wild and fantastic animals also taking part in the battle on the good side. The second type of characters is the easiest one. These are the humans represented as the Sogdian warriors should be represented. We have them as knights, as mounted warriors. We have them as musicians. And most importantly, the humans are led by the main protagonist of the paintings. He appears at least five times. He usually drives a chariot drawn by winged horses. Here you can see, drawn by winged horses. I call him the king because he has numerous royal attributes. The crowns are not that specific, but what is specific is what he holds here. This is most probably an axe, and axe is, here you can see it also. An axe is an explicit royal attribute in Sogdian art. We have it with various royal representations in Sogdian art, from Panjikent, where the king always has this axe. And also the fact that this figure never takes active part in the fight itself, although he is shown at least twice wearing armor, but he never fights himself. Also something which lets us to think that we're talking here about the king, because we deliberated between a hero and the king, but hero, as we know from the Rustam paintings from Panjikent, is expected to be an active fighter, and this is not definitely not the case here. These are the parallels for the royal iconography from Panjikent. So here you can see also another example of this king wearing armor and holding something which can be some long-shafted weapon, probably a trident or a spear. And he's also shown standing in the upper register once. He's easily recognizable because of this very curious detail of his garment, perhaps related somehow to the Sasanian apizak, but this is something that we still need to see. And perhaps he's also shown during the final battle, where in the lower register, where we have the end of the painting, very few fragments are preserved. But there is actually Sokolovsky reconstructed here. You see some type of fantastic birds, but in fact, only one wing is preserved. So we think that it can equally perhaps be winged horses and an attribute of this king. Now, the curious detail, which we do not know if there is any significance for this, and it's also a question for Nikita, because the chariot of the king is decorated with this curious floral design, which also appears to be a part of this humanoids with fangs, who are the opponents of the king. Is this only an ornament? Does it have any meaning? And if it does it hint on some relations between these humanoid creatures and the king leading with humans? We don't know. Now, the gods are clearly seen assisting the humans. For example, in this scene, there the humans suffer defeat, and they are retreating under the fleeing from the onslaught of these humanoids with fangs. You can see they're terrified, the horses are galloping, and the king is begging for help to the goddess Nana here. Now, here again, she is depicted in the upper register. You can see here. There are also other divine characters also featuring in the paintings, like this god with a trident, and this god, mountain god with three heads, probably to be identified as the Sogdian god Veshparkar, who is covering for the fleeing humans. He's the only one whose horse is depicted standing and not galloping like the horse of the fleeing humans. So he's really helping them. And we have this curious flying, you can see here the wing, flying creature, which should be probably ascribed to the good side. Now, the type of characters that that we call demons. These are only this type of creatures. They are naked, they have a standing hair, they have a ferocious, an extremely ferocious appearance or probably with skulls. They're half naked. They're shown in whimsical poses. And what is most important, they never have weapons and they never fight. If you look on the iconography, they appear only in the context where they are depicted either standing by the side of the king, the human king, or by the side of the gods. Yeah, here you can see these ferocious demons, and here they are accompanying the chariot of the king, but never fighting themselves. They don't have the weapons. So at least to me, it is absolutely clear that these demons, they are not the opponents of the king, but they are some kind of subordinated, enslaved demons, devs, who serve the king. And this is, of course, one of the most commonly found motif in the Iranian epos, and many kings and heroes are characterized by being masters and enslavers of the devs and demons, and France is going to elaborate on this point, but this is one of the important distinctions, in my opinion, if we want to understand the logic of this painting. You can see the examples of these demon types again, of these demons. Yeah. Now the iconographic parallels. Of course, it was mentioned here already. They resemble the tantric iconography. There are probably earlier parallels for this kind of demons from, well, maybe the date is too optimistic here and it should be later, but still there is this iconography of such demonic figures from Xinjiang, and probably also this figure from Kashmir, which is usually dated to the 7th century. The key features are standing hair and the fearsome appearance. But please do note that all these demons, they do have, or this also depiction from Pilio Chinois, from Xinjiang, that they always have weapons. Yes, they are king of demons, they are important figures, but this is not the case in our paintings. They appear enslaved and dominated. The best parallel to this kind of demons is, to my opinion, is this depiction dated to the 10th century from this banner depicting the guardian of the West from Dunhuang. And yes, and here you can see the same type of demon. So this is one major point. Now we move to the second type of creatures who are not demons, in my opinion, but they are rather humanoids with fangs and sometimes also with wings. Yep, you can see them. These are their major iconographical characters. They have this vivid expression. The eyebrows are raised. They sometimes have crown and they have fangs. And this is all. This is not how you usually depict the demons in the Sogdian art. Yeah, here you can see various types of these creatures. One of them is has negroid features and is dark skinned. Yep, here they are. You can see the only feature is raised eyebrow and the fang. Yep. Several examples. Some of them fight on foot. Some of them are mounted. They are led by a king, who is distinguished also by this curious ornament, crest-shaped, which is made of small bells. And this king appears once in the middle register and once in this curious scene to which we identify him here because of this ornament of bells in this scene, which I will go back to it. Now, the best iconographic parallel to the depiction of this humanoid creatures that we were able to find is this curious depiction of demon with lamp from Beziklik, also dated from 8th to 10th century. You can see the two main characteristics here, raised eyebrow and fangs. Now, if this type of creatures, they are not demons and they are not humans, who could they be? Now, of course, in the Iranian epic tradition, there is a third type of creatures who are later known to have their own kings and their own armies, and these are the Paris, the fairies. In pre-Islamic Iran, the Parika are described as female evil sorceresses, but since in the late tradition they are known to be also male, this transformation and the appearance and the perception that the Paris could also be perceived as male should have taken place somewhere in the late Sasanian, early Islamic period, because in the early Islamic period we have the Arabic jinn, which also determines the entire race, and not only of beings, and not only female. The Arabic jinn is usually translated in Persian as the pari. And in the Shahnameh, we have several instances where the paris are described as being part of the armies. The impression is that already at the stage of Shahnameh, the paris could be perceived also as males. But we're not going to insist that these characters, and of course the main thing is also wings. We're not going to insist on this point, but only to insist on the distinction that there is no one demon, one category of demons, but rather two very different categories of characters. The last category is, of course, the wild men. These are ugly men with ugly features, with thick noses and strange hairdresses. This is the main characteristic, is thick noses and strange hairdressers. We have similar wild men in from Panji Kent, and curiously, they are also found in the Umayyad art. For example, in this example from Qasr al-Khair al-Garbi in Syria, where also no convincing interpretation was put forward for this ugly men. They were suggested to depict prisoners, or copied from the masks of. The Roman theater, but I think the iconographical similarity is striking. One small comment on the large figure which appears in the painted niche in front of the main hall. It was often connected with our main protagonist, but the main difference is that this figure, who is undoubtedly a divine figure following the convention of the Sogdian art, sits on the throne supported by wingless horses, while our king has winged horses. And also, in Panji Kent, the depictions of the gods in the main niche, the huge figure, is usually not related at all to the paintings scene. Now, there is a very curious detail in the lower register, just before the depiction of the final banquet. This is how the Sogdian epic paintings should probably end, with the victory and the banquet. There is this curious depiction of one standing figure and three figures, two of them kneeling and one of them clearly standing, touching hand of this character. This was usually interpreted as a scene of surrender. I do not believe it can be a surrender, because one character is standing and one do not surrender if he stands. It makes no clear sense. So it should probably be an oath, a kind of oath. I was struck by the significance of the hand, of the touching of the hand, of the handshake. Because in the Arabic and the Islamic tradition, the main pledge of allegiance which one makes to the caliph, it's called bayah, and it is the main ritual associated with it is the handshake. So, for example, if you look on bayah still being performed today by ISIS militants of various Sufi orders, and this is the bayah given to the Sheikh of the Ahmadiyya Sufi order, one can clearly see this touching on of the hand. And so the wild suggestion, I would say, is could this oath represent an illustration of the Baya, which was certainly known in Sogdiana, because they were obliged, the Sogdian princes, to give the Baya to the caliph, and this is how one would depict it. And I will end this part of presentation, of course, one important iconographic connection. We have this scene from Penji Ken 3.6, which was known long ago, of a chariot drawn by winged horses driving towards a figure on a lion, which is clearly and without any doubt what we see here. So the connection was already made, but the important point, which went overlooked and it was never recognized, that in the same room in Penji Ken, we also have the depiction of Rustam, the great hero involved in the scene of sacrifice. So this scene from Penji Ken 3 gives us a clear link between the paintings of the Shah Rustam, of Shahristan, and Rustam, and thus probably to the Kayanid circle. And I leave the floor to Franz to present the ideas of interpretation now. Thank you.
As a result of Michael's presentation, some features can be selected which orientate towards an identification of the subject of this epic cycle. The upper register presents a kind of a dramatis personae. It is a static gallery with no narration. It presents gods, ferocious animals, real or fantastic, heroes standing or banqueting, but not the demon warriors who appear defeated in the narrative which follows. The middle and lower register show a continuous narrative. On the basis of the Penji Ken epic cycles, one can safely assume that the story finished in the lower register with the banquet scene. In this lower register, clearly the narrative proceeds from left to right. It was probably so in the middle register, in which case the starting point, eastern wall left, is almost destroyed. Don't know how the story began. In various places, we can recognize the recurring figure of a king wearing a winged crown of late Sasanian type, also used on coins of the Ustrushana kings. In five instances, he sits in a chariot drawn by winged horses. He also presides over the final banquet, seated on a throne carried by winged creatures, which could also be winged horses. Though clad in armor, he never personally takes part in the fighting, which is entrusted to a group of knights. A maximum number of six knights appear in the final banquet, which echoes the conventional number of dynastic founders' companions or great families of the Achaemenids, Arsacids, and Sassanids. In one case, the king draws his chariot towards the goddess Nana, extending his palm in what seems to be a gesture of homage or supplication, while his troop is in flight. All the enemies have a human look with slight demoniac features, fangs, protruding eyes, raised eyebrows. They appear to have their own rulers, as most of them wear crowns. In two instances, these warriors have wings in addition. As shown by Michael, these can probably be identified as masculinized paris, creatures called in the Avesta pairika, which means winged. The other adversaries should perhaps be classified rather under the general category dev, demons, though Michael prefers the term humanoids. All these foes seems to be likely over human size. At least the ones we call paris fight on foot, while their antagonists are riding. On the middle register of the northern wall, on the left side, a sort of female angel, she has breasts, flies down from heaven, presumably to bring help. All these features, except for the direct intervention of gods in battles, have parallels in the Panjikent epic paintings, especially those which have been identified as episodes of the Kayanid cycle, the story of Rostam, or Peri-Kayanid cycles, the story of Faramarz. Thrown carried by winged horses or griffins are also documented on three dishes showing Sasanian or Kushano-Sasanian kings. Such considerations invite us to look tentatively for identifications with heroes of the Iranian tradition, known to us from both religious texts and texts belonging to the epic tradition, namely Arab and Persian elaborations from the lost Pahlavi Book of Kings, the Huadai Nomag. Among these heroes, two are associated with episodes which provide possible analogies with the Charistan painted cycle. The first hero is Garshasp in the Avesta Kirsaspa, sometimes named Sam in later texts. In the Yasht of the Avesta, Kirsaspa is mentioned as offering sacrifices to both Anahita and Vayu. In the Sogdian pantheon depicted in our paintings, these deities were reshaped, respectively, as Nana and Dueshparkar, the latter god having borrowed the iconographic type of Shiva. In our painting, Nana is worshipped by the king, while Dueshparkar is shooting arrows in order to cover the retreat of the army. In the various versions of his story, Garshasp, like Heracles, purges the earth of various categories of villains. An aquatic demon called the Gandharva, giants, highwaymen, Pitaona with his many Pairikas, his Taspa with the golden crown, plus three groups of brothers. He also fights monstrous animals, enumerated in the Menogichrad. Some beings belonging to these various groups might be recognized in the painting. Giants, paris, demoniac enemies wearing crowns. Also, in the bestiary grouped in the upper register, three of the animals enumerated in the Menogichrad: a giant bird, a wolf, and a horned dragon. But this identification meets with serious objections. If this is Garshasp's story, where is Garshasp? He can hardly be the king in the chariot, for Garshasp is never designated as a king, except in a Shahnameh passage suspected to be an interpolation, and in the late Tarikh-e Sistan. He cannot be one of the knights either, because none of them really stands above the others. Moreover, Garshasp is a solitary hero who fights hand in hand and has one companion at the most. Also, his main deed, the victory over the Gandharva, which is the only favor he asks from Anahita, is not recognizable anywhere in the painting. So Michael and I consider another ancient Iranian hero has better qualifications. This hero is the King Kaikavus. Several important episodes of his career, as can be found in various layers of the Iranian tradition, can plausibly be recognized in the painting. According to the Pahlavi books Denkart and Bundahishn, Kaus ruled 150 years over demons and men. Most of his reign was occupied by wars, always disastrous in the beginning and successful in the end, against various enemies of Iran. In the main episodes, these foes are the Mazanik Dewan, etymologically giant demons, but eventually understood as the demons of Mazenderan. In the Aban Yasht, Kaus asks from Anahita victory over, I quote, demons, men, sorcerers, pyrikas, despotic cavies, carapan, a diversity which could well be reflected by the various types of foes in this painting. Though sometimes going himself to the war, Kawad doesn't fight in person, but he entrusts his army to several champions: Rostam, Giv, Godarz, Tus, and some others. One strange feature of the king depicted here is his constant association with winged horses. In the case of the throne on which he sits in the last episode, this could be just an artistic device, as it is with the throne of some Sasanian rulers. But in scenes where he rides in his chariot, one is obliged to consider that his horses has a real capacity to fly. If not, it would be meaningless. Among all Kayanid rulers, only one has a marked tendency to ascend the sky. This ruler is Kay Kavus. Already in the Abanyasht of the Avesta, he sacrifices to Anahita on the top of the so-called Eagle Mountain. In later traditions, this story became more and more enriched with fantastic details. In the Denkart, Kavus is persuaded by the demon of wrath to conquer heaven, and in order to do so, he ascends Mount Haribur's in the company of demons. His army is thrown down, while Kavus manages to fly back by some nondescript device, thanks to the intercession of the flying god Narsé and of the Fravashi, pre-created soul, of his grandson Khosrow, also presumably flying. In the Shahnameh and in other Arabo-Persian versions, Kawad attempts unsuccessfully to ascend the sky in a sophisticated machine. A scene of the northern wall, in the northern wall, a fragmentary composition at the left of the middle register recalls some of these motifs. Here, one can see the king's chariot accompanied by two bestial demons with disheveled hair, modeled on wrathful deities of Hindu or tantric iconography. They are clearly submissive. One seems to crawl under the chariot, the other executes a gesture of homage. More to the left, a female flying figure flies down from the sky, resembling the Fravashis depicted on Panjikent paintings. Yeah, here, on the top of a battle scene. A giant bird of prey is depicted under this Fravashi, but only one pole survives. This is not Kavus' throne pulled by eagles, as described in later literature and miniatures. But this motif is considered to have been borrowed from the romance of Alexander. There were other ways, actually, to visualize Kavus' ascent to the sky. Tabari merely states that he rose as far as the clouds, while Biruni mentions just a chariot of clouds, no throne pulled by eagles. Well, unfortunately, what is left of the composition on that part of the northern wall does not allow us to pursue further the comparison. Better preserved scenes in the lower register of the same wall, actually the last episode before the final banquet, find more precise echoes in another episode of The Adventures of Kavus. Here we see a castle built of rocks or hollowed in rocks. Rocks are rendered according to an accepted convention. As noticed by Sokolovsky, the architectural frieze surmounting this castle is shown also on top of preceding episodes, starting with the battle scene on the Southern Wall, which could indicate that from this episode onwards, all the struggles take part near the castle. In the full version preserved on the northern wall, the castle overlooks a stream or a pool. It is inhabited by demons wearing crowns. A warrior is crossing the bridge over the waters. He holds an arrow in his hand as he is ready to shoot. Perhaps the arrow is meant to convey an attached message to the besiegers, a device described in the Karnama Giardashir. The following scene shows three characters, one of whom at least is also a ruler of demons. They swear an oath to one of the king's companions, in Arabic fashion as shown by Michael in his paper. Then come three or four demons lying on the floor with hands and feet bound, obviously awaiting their execution. The whole narrative is closed by the banquet scene. Starting with the Pahlavi texts, Kaus is consistently associated with a mansion or a city built on top of a mountain with water flowing from springs. In Tabari and Balami, one finds some additional details, which presumably were already present in the Huadai Nomag. The mansion was built for Kaus by the demons, who eventually aroused his anger, as a result of which they had their commanders executed. All important features of this story appear on the painting. The castle in the rocks, the water, the demoniac garrison, the execution of the commanders. One of the oath takers seems to be already depicted in the middle register of the northern wall in a sort of a story within the story. One can recognize him from his crown and his band with bells crossed over his chest. In a first scene, he kneels in front of two knights of the opposite army, executing a gesture of respect. In the next scene, one can piece together from fragments he's standing naked in the fire. So the fragments are in wrong order, but here you can recognize the crown. There are flames, and in other fragments, not put together with the others on this reconstruction, but documented, you can see actually parts of the neck, body, and the hand. Very tentatively, I would propose to recognize this demon as a repentant demon submitted to an ordeal or a purification ritual in the fire. This former demon reappears, as I said, he seems to reappear among the oath takers after the surrender of the castle. Such an episode is not found in the extant texts. It can be considered a specific embroidery by the local storytellers. It is certainly surprising that Rostam, the main champion of Kaus, is not represented, or at least not recognizable, in this painted cycle. For at Panjikent, he has unmistakable physical features and attributes, the panther skin and a particular facial characters. Was the painter asked to highlight only the figure of King Kaus? In a Panjikent painting already mentioned by Michael, a king approaching Nana in a chariot drawn by winged horses is part of the same story as Rostam, depicted as is always at Panjikent with his kaftan made of panther skin. This association provides a direct confirmation that our king in a chariot drawn by Pigezi is Kaus. King Kaus is certainly not the most dignified of the Kayanid kings. Somehow, he is to kings of Iran what Donald Trump is to the presidents of the United States. With his extravagances and repeated failures, he figures rather poorly between his predecessor, Kawad, and the archetype, who is the archetype of the good king, and his successor, Khosrow, the eschatological hero, the immortal, also his own army leader, Rostam. In the whole Sasanian dynasty, the name of Kawad was carried only by one prince, a son of Kawad, the name of Kaus, was carried only by one prince, a son of Kawad I. Nevertheless, Kaus was considered the founder of Samarkand, and at the end of the 8th century, Haidar Afshin's father and predecessor was named Kaus. Is it one of the keys to explain the identification we consider most plausible for the main hero of the paintings in the small hall. Still in the 830s, in neighboring Fergana, a temple dedicated to the sun, thus presumably to the Sogdian Mithra, was said to have been built by Kaikous. This temple was eventually destroyed in an Arab raid under the Caliph Al-Mutasim, whose chief general in Baghdad was Haidar Afshin. Perhaps Kaikous had a particular title to please the Ustrushanian Afshins before they became Muslim. Of all the Kayanid kings, he was the one who most often led expeditions against the Arabs. So, did the pictorial language in the Shahristan Palace convey a coded political message, as it has been supposed for the Varaksha paintings, showing a king fighting a series of wild beasts and monsters? At the moment, I prefer to refrain from further speculation. Thank you.